Hello and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. This is Omar Sadr. Turkey's AKP party is a Rorschach test for those who are interested to understand the relationship between Islamism on one hand and democracy on the other hand. Since AKP into power, Erdogan has taken Turkey towards a much more authoritarianism, that we are much more scholars are now talking about democratic backsliding in Turkey. In this episode, I spoke with one of the key Turkish political scientists, Selin Bingi Gumrukcu. Bingi is a lecturer currently at the University of Rutgers in the US. She studies various aspects of social movements, political parties, far-right, violence, and Europeanization. She also focuses on democratic backsliding in Turkey. Bingi has received her PhD from University of Zurich in 2014. Her more recent article is titled Populist Discourse, Counter-Mobilization, and Democratic Backsliding in Turkey. In this episode, I thoroughly enjoyed Bingi's analysis on democratic backsliding in Turkey, how Erdogan is using counter-mobilization, also the relationship between party structure, Islamism, and de-democratization in Turkey. On to the podcast now. Bingi Gumrukcu, welcome to Negotiating Ideas. Thanks for your time.
Hi, Omar. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So I'm interested to speak with you about the prospect of democratization and de-democratization in Turkey that you have extensively written about. So let's start by talking about how, since when de-democratization took place or this democratic backsliding. So at least liberals in Turkey were concerned since 2007 that the incumbent political party is taking certain steps, which is pushing Turkey towards authoritarianism. But in terms of, if you give some numbers and data that you also have talked about, Freedom House has been ranking Turkey at least since 2018 as a non-free country, which is itself moving back Turkey to 1980s when it was under the military rule. So walk us through a bit about some of the key factors that the incumbent AKP party is taking towards authoritarianism.
Yeah, sure. Well, I have to say that, you know, like, this is kind of like a tricky question, because when you look in the literature, you are going to see that there are several different, you know, like, turning points that are provided by the scholars. Some are suggesting that it started, you know, like, after 2013. Some are suggesting that, you know, like, it started early on. So it's kind of depending on, you know, like, what kind of a definition of democratic backsliding or authoritarianism you are taking into account. And I have to also say that, you know, like, the Turkish case is a little bit interesting because when the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, came to power, you know, like, in the early 2000s, you know, like, many in the society, including the intellectuals or the liberals, they had high hopes for democratization in the country. Because, you know, like, the AKP came to power promising more democratization, you know, like, EU membership. They had, like, a more Western outlook in that regard. So, they, you know, like, we can say that they promised to democratize the country regarding the human rights, the Kurdish issue, local administrations, as well as the judiciary. And also, when you look at their, you know, like, party documents, like, party programs or election manifestos, especially in the early years, you are seeing a more, you know, like, Europhile attitude. And especially in the initial years, thanks to the EU conditionality, actually, we are seeing that the government passed some reform packages, which was regulating the judiciary. They abolished the death penalty, for example, and maybe more significantly, you know, like, weakened the military in their power to interfere in civilian politics.
Right.
But as we also see, you know, like, in other competitive authoritarian regimes, the decline has been more gradual Mm-hmm. Right. So it was not a result of a military coup or, you know, like another shock, let's say, in the political system.
That's right.
So, you know, like it's a little bit, this is why a little bit tricky to set like a turning point. But I can talk about some turning points that are referenced in the literature. So if you would look at, for example, data from varieties of democracy project, you would see that several different aspects of democracy started to decline around 2007, which is like the second electoral victory of the AKP.
AKP.
Yeah. And around this time, we are seeing the secular Kemalist groups in the society were alarmed with this second victory by the AKP, and they started some, you know, like mass demonstrations against the government, which were dubbed as the Republican rallies or the Republic rallies, depending on, you know, like how you translate it. This series of mass mobilizations were followed with what we call as the Ergenekon Balyoz process in Turkish. In 2008-2009 period, which targeted, you know, like the military, some civil society organizations, some journalists, some intellectuals in the society who were part of these mass rallies, as well as the military, some military officers who were claimed to be, you know, like in preparation of a coup plot against the government. So these trials can be suggested that they divided the opposition into those seeing, you know, like these measures are necessary to curtail the military tutelage, and those who were viewing them as kind of like conspiracies to eliminate the secularist opposition. So this is why when, you know, like some scholars would refer to this period as, you know, like the signals of democratic backsliding, because there were a lot of, you know, like procedures in the judicial process which kind of culminated, I would say, the rule of law. Some others were celebrating this process as, you know, like as a necessary step to curtail the military's power in the civilian politics. And then another, you know, like turning point, which is referred to in the literature, is the 2010 constitutional amendments, which can be accepted as a, you know, like major point, major turning point, not only for democratic backsliding in the country, but also de-Europeanization from a legal and formal perspective. I think it was Murat Sevinç, a scholar of constitutional law, he was suggesting that unconstitutionalism in the country started with these amendments, because the constitution itself was degraded and defamed, which eventually led to the legitimization of unconstitutionality. And again, if you would look at, you know, like the data from varieties of democracy project, for example, you would see that the executive in Turkey started to respect the constitution significantly less since the implementation of these constitutional amendments. Another turning point might be the election victory in 2011 by the Justice and Development Party, which helped the party to consolidate its power further. And according to, you know, like Erdogan himself, this election victory was ending the era of its apprenticeship and starting its, you know, like, let's say, mastership in their of their power.
Yeah.
I think the next major turning point was the 2013 Gezi Park protests. And I would say this is like one of the most referenced turning points in the literature. We are seeing that these protests, which spread all around, you know, like the whole country, they were organized in 80 cities out of 81, and it attracted millions of people from different political backgrounds, including the Turkish nationalists, you know, like the secular Kemalists, the pro-Kurdish, you know, like groups, is accepted as a critical juncture. And I can talk more about it, you know, like later on. And if you would, again, look at data from several databases, including the Varieties of Democracy Project, you would see that it's like a really critical juncture
Yeah, thank you for that. So you have covered almost one decade of democratic backsliding, and it's, as you mentioned, it's not a moment of a kind of conventional or classic mm-hmm. form of de-democratization where a coup happens, mm-hmm. but it's gradually redesigning, reshuffling institutions, laws, and also certain form of political structures which impacts democracy. And so let me get to the last reference that you gave on Gezi Park, and you have written on that. So you are saying that Gezi Park has been compared with, for example, 1968 protests in Europe mm-hmm. and other moments. But you try to argue that instead of looking at it as a isolated event, mm-hmm. we have to consider this Gezi Park protest as a cycle of protests, mm-hmm. Where, for example, there are certain forms of strategies or practices, both, for example, the protesters and also later on the counter-mobilization protests which happens by the incumbent take place. So how do you contextualize that one at the Gezi Park in terms of the encounter between these two forces?
Well, I would say that, you know, like the Gezi Park protests were quite important for Turkish political history, but also the history of social movements in Turkey. And as you suggest, you know, like instead of seeing it as a social movement on its own or a revolution or, you know, like some other phenomenon, I try to conceptualize Gezi Park protest as a cycle of protest, which was shaped with the political opportunity structures that were available to it. And it, you know, like when we look at it, we are seeing that it started in late May 2013. It, you know, like increased in intensity over the course of the following few weeks, and then it started to gradually decline the you know, like the levels of mobilization. But I suggest that, you know, like this Gezi Park protests were not only important for you know, like the opposition in the country, but it was also kind of like an important point for AKP's, you know, like power, because yeah. this was a moment that kind of shook the party, let's say. This was happening, you know, like after, not right after, but following the Arab Spring in the MENA region. And this was like the first, let's say, mass mobilization that was, you know, like opposing the AKP's, you know, like increasing power and hegemony in the country. And when we look at it, we are seeing that the government's reaction to this Gezi Park protests were harsher than their reaction to the former waves of, you know, like protests, which included the Republic rallies, as I mentioned, or the labor protests around 2010 period. And it can be suggested that, you know, like this reaction coming from the government was so harsh that it deepened social polarization, thus, you know, challenging the party's democratic credentials.
Go on, please.
You know, like, for example, very famously, Erdogan stated that that the 50% of the country, where he was like referring to his water base, are at home now, and that the government is like having trouble keeping them off the streets. So kind of, you know, like again, increasing the polarization between the supporters of the AKP and those who are opposing their power.
And one incident, for example, which happened in 2015, which was of course connected to 2013 protest, was killing of two of the, if I'm not wrong, the lawyers who were trying to prosecute or follow up the case of one of the young guys, Birkin Elvin, where in this incident particularly, the illegal Marxist party was involved, which is, I think, if I'm not wrong, it's called Revolutionary People's Liberation Party. Mm-hmm. So in terms of polarization, when you see this, Turkey is, of course, like many other contemporary Western democracies, it's not just about economic divide, but it's also identity issues. Mm-hmm. And this particular incident, also the Alevis, which are coming from a left, predominantly left, they are supporting the left constancy. But also beyond Turkey, they have good relationship with Syria. You have that, them on one side, and then majority of the society who are Sunnis, and the incumbent AKP is trying to mobilize that rhetoric. So AKP and Erdogan has, and deliberately in certain cases, has tried to play with, for example, sectarian identity of Sunnis versus Alevis, and also other kind of cleavages which exist in the society. To what extent now you think, since 2013 onwards, such kind of polarization has deepened?
Yeah. Well, let me first say that, you know, like polarization in Turkey, of course, did not start with the Justice and Development Party's rule, right? We have seen back in the time, you know, like pogroms targeting the non-Muslim minorities. We have seen attacks targeting the Alevi communities in the 1970s, for example. We had very unfortunate, you know, like incidents. And also, you know, like ethnic minorities there have been in the country from the very beginning. So, you know, like we can talk about different polarization, different aspects of polarization in the 1960s and 70s between, you know, like left wing and right wing groups who were clashing on the streets every day. In the 1980s, we can say that this kind of took the form of more with the not emergence, but empowerment of political Islam and Kurdish nationalism. Let's say it took a different, you know, like turn. But we can say that, you know, like maybe the durability of this polarization, you know, like kind of intensified, especially after the 2013 Gezi Park protests. We know that, you know, like this did not only polarize the political, you know, like different political groups in the country, but also after that, we are starting to see an intra-party or intra, you know, like let's say government circles conflict starting, especially with the, you know, like with the division between the Gulenists and the Justice and Development Party, which culminated into the failed coup attempt in 2016.
Yeah.
Well, like when you look at it, some surveys are showing very interesting data on polarization in Turkey. According to one you know, like survey by Turquoise Lab, for example, I think this is like one of the most recent data. This was a survey conducted in 2020. So it's very interesting showing the levels of not only political polarization, but also social polarization in the society. Because the 75% of the respondents to the survey are suggesting that they do not want their daughter to marry someone who is voting for the party that they feel distant to.
Right, okay.
So 72% of the respondents do not want to do business with the people who are voting for the party that they don't like, let's
yeah.
say.
Mm.
About 70% of the respondents do not want their kid to play with the kids of, you know, like people who are voting for the party that they don't like.
Mm.
60% of people, they do not want to be neighbors with people who are voting for the party they do not like, right? Mm. So we are seeing that this kind of like a very intensified social polarization. I mean, it's kind of normal, right? Like in the political sphere, that political parties, as they are competing for the power in the country, they're going to criticize each other and they're going to keep their distance to a certain level. But these numbers are showing us that this political polarization has a societal impact, which is very significant. And also the same survey is showing that, you know, while political party respondents are associating, you know, like, let's say positive attributes, such as, I don't know, being a good citizen, or being the man of, you know, like honor, with the supporters of the party that they're voting for. And they are associating very negative attributes with the parties, with the supporters of the parties that they feel most distant to. These negative attributes are, you know, like including words and subjects like arrogant, hypocrite, cruel, you know. And it would not be, you know, like wrong to suggest that this is kind of the reflection of the language and the political sphere to the social sphere.
Right. So on this, for example, let me get to the kind of rhetoric or vocabulary that Erdogan himself tries to use when he was trying to counter-mobilize the secularists in the society. And you have written on this, and discursively you have analyzed the discourses of AKP's party and for example, political vilification. Or some other techniques. Talk about some of the techniques or what you call it as a reporter of action when it comes to counter-mobilization. So these were the moments that Erdogan tried to create kind of dichotomy or us, which was very good, and demonizing the others who are, I mean, the opponents of AKP.
First, you know, like, let me remind you the study which was published by The Guardian focusing on the populist rhetoric of, you know, several leaders around the world. And if I remember well, Erdogan was, you know, like one of the top leaders who uses a very populist rhetoric. And according to the same study, we are seeing that Erdogan's rhetoric became very populist in 2014, which was just after the Gezi Park protests, right? So I thought, you know, like, it's kind of important to look at Erdogan's rhetoric during this period, because we can say that, you know, like, the ideological content can be communicated through this rhetoric, right?
Yeah.
And okay. For this reason, I analyzed Erdogan's rhetoric during what is called as the Respect to the National Will rallies in 2013, which was kind of like a counter-mobilization to the Gezi Park protests. So these were kind of like top-down organized rallies by the AKP in several different cities in Turkey. And I identified, four different discursive mechanisms used during these rallies, which are nomination, predication, argumentation, and intensification, as they are, you know, like referred to in the literature. But we can say that, you know, basically kind of like using this populist rhetoric that is identifying the good and the evil, we are seeing that, you know, like, Erdogan was able to construct the people, quote unquote, during his, you know, like, speeches in his rallies. And he was like suggesting basically that the people who are attending the rallies, the pro-government rallies, were, quote unquote, the people. He was, for example, saying that those who want to see and understand Turkey should come here to Ankara to see it, referring to, you know, like, the crowd that gathered for his own rallies, as opposed to those people who were protesting in the Gezi Park. So kind of like constructing a binary, right, between those who attended the rally in Ankara and the anti-government protesters in Istanbul's Gezi Park. But we also see that, you know, like, Erdogan is kind of using predication, which is kind of cultivating a binary between the kind of like the POS people versus the estranged elites. And this can also, you know, like, maybe answer your question regarding polarization, because we are seeing that Erdogan is referring to those who have participated in his rallies as the quiet masses, highlighting that the supporters of his party were the ones who, you know, like, who have been historically repressed by the ruling secular Kemalist elites, right? So kind of like victimizing or playing the victim, you know, like, here, that he's suggesting that his party changed the country's path to put an end to this injustice by the early elites. And in this regard, you know, like when you are putting this quiet masses rhetoric, you are kind of, you know, like talking about the others, right? Who are estranged from the religious values of the society. For example, during this, you know, like one of these rallies, he suggested that the supporters of his party are not resisting with vandalism or lies or slander, but they are resisting with, you know, like prayers, with namaz, you know, like the religious practices. So kind of, you know, like he's suggesting that those people who are participating in the protests are staging some immoral behavior, and they're using violence, and they are using, you know, like social media, foreign press to organize and disseminate, you know, like information or misinformation. But on the other hand, his supporters are remaining, you know, like silent, you know, like they're continuing their daily work and their religious practices. And this is kind of, you know, like drawing a line between the faithful and the people on the one hand and the unbelievers and the elites on the other hand.
Yeah.
And also very heavily, when we, to put it very briefly, we are seeing that, you know, he's very harshly criticizing the opposite, you know, like the opponents, and kind of presenting the other in a very negative way, whereas he's referring to his own supporters in a very positive way. So.
Right, right. So on the issue of populism that you referred, you are considering it as a kind of political communication strategy of Erdogan, rather than populism as a core ideology of his party. How do you differentiate it, and why do you say it's not an ideology for Erdogan?
Well, let me, you know, like mention an article by Hans-Peter Kriese, who also happens to be my PhD supervisor. He published this article in 2018, if I'm not mistaken. It's called Revisiting the Populist Challenge. And in this article, he suggests that, you know, like both populism as ideology, I mean, as you know, there are different, you know, like conceptualizations of populism as ideology, right, as political strategy, as discourse. He's suggesting that populism as ideology and populism as political strategy, actually, they are not so different from, you know, like populism as rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. Because they are closely related. For example, he's giving the example from Hawkins, who is suggesting that discourse is something that combines the elements of both ideology and rhetoric, right? So populists, discourse here can be accepted as something that is reflecting the ideology, right? It's kind of like a communication strategy of the populist actors who has a populist ideology, if you want to say that. And also, you know, like it is related to the political strategy approach to populism, because we are seeing that populists are going to the public. Right. They're establishing a direct relationship between the personalistic leader and the citizen audience. And here, too, the discourse is kind of like a tool to establish this link. So I would say I'm not, you know, like necessarily denying or that literature which focuses on populism as ideology. On the other hand, sure, I'm just suggesting that this is kind of complementing it in a way that the discourse is the reflection of the ideology.
Sure, and you have mentioned about populism, how Erdogan is mobilizing vis-a-vis, for example, strange elites. But also, I think when we talk about polarization, I also think that to what extent populism impacts badly pluralism in a society. So this, you can say, of course, political pluralism is about what we spoke about, democratic backsliding, but I mean here pluralism in a broader sense, which includes religious and cultural pluralism. So to what extent do you consider this is incumbent government impacting badly the pluralistic peaceful coexistence in Turkey?
I would suggest, you know, like some policies, some, you know, like actions, as well as the rhetoric that I analyzed in my one of my recent articles is kind of contributing to this process, which is impacting pluralism in a negative way too, right?
Yeah.
Because when you look at this rhetoric that was employed during these rallies, you are seeing that, you know, like the government side is portraying their supporters and themselves as the defender of the society's moral values against the westernized and alienated youth, calling the protesters as looters, for example, very famously, çapulcular in Turkish. So this is something our colleague Lizal Hintz also called as rhetorical vilification. And this is not only delegitimizing the protests and the protesters, but it's also, you know, like kind of in a way creating a situation where any opposition to the incoming regime can be, you know, like framed as a scheme, a scenario, a plan, and the protesters or the opponents can be blamed as, you know, like the traitors, vandals, you know, like looters. So it's kind of giving this rhetorical power to the incumbent to frame everything that they dislike as a plot of the dark circles, you know, like interest lobbies, enemies of the will of the people, and, you know, like some other groups. And when we look at it, we are seeing that, you know, like pluralism in the country today is not at the levels of, you know, like prior times. I mean, I cannot say that, you know, like Turkey has been a very pluralistic society before the AKP, but we are seeing, you know, like in all parts of the later life, we are seeing the incumbent parties impact ranging from, you know, like the university and higher education system to, you know, like how many kids families should have. We are seeing, you know, like now cases that are targeting, you know, like one of the opposition parties, which is namely the pro-Kurdish People's Democratic Party, by the Constitutional Court, which can lead to its closure. We are seeing, you know, like the country withdrawing from, you know, like the Istanbul Convention, which is, you know, like an international treaty to combat gender-based violence, which created a lot of, you know, like criticism from the women's movement in the country. We are seeing, you know, like the annual Pride that is organized in Istanbul mostly, being, you know, like interrupted by the security forces. We are seeing, you know, like increased number of anti-LGBTQI, you know, like protests in the country. We are seeing the vilification of, let's say, slogans, like famous slogans in Turkey, such as Türkiye layıktır, layık kalacak, Turkey is secular and it's going to remain so, by the Kemalist groups. And this is even, you know, like this slogan can be accepted or framed as a form of, you know, like vandalism, or even to a certain extent as a, you know, like criminal, let's say, slogan.
Right.
So we are seeing that it's not leaving any space for ethnic, religious, social minorities in the society, just harming the pluralism.
Right, right. So now, probably in the last section, if we can talk about this tension which exists always between liberalism and Islamism.
Mm-hmm.
And the dominant hypothesis in Middle East is that Islamist parties are not trustworthy. Because as soon as they come to power, even through democratic means, the soon they will catch power, they will try to reshuffle the institutions and Islamize the entire political system. And one of the typical cases, of course, in Arab Spring, you had cases like Egypt, Muslim Brotherhood, the first party, and also Noor Party, the second one, the Salafis came to power, but they didn't try to pass legislation to heavily Islamize political system. Mm-hmm. But there were concerns about it, the same in Tunisia. Now, in case of Erdogan is unique because this is a kind of Rorschach test, wherein many people see, well, here, look, the case of Turkey, which is in a kind of mode. He came as a kind of Muslim democrat, but he gradually shifted to an Islamist kind of autocrat. Now my question is, do you really consider this move from an Muslim democrat Erdogan to an Islamist autocrat Erdogan coming from Islamism, the ideology of the party, or an alternative narrative or explanation for the same thing is that how Turkey has been moving toward authoritarianism, particularly under an Islamist government, is an explanation coming from a scholar called Jenny White, who says Turkey, particularly Erdogan, is a kind of big man, and it's coming from a political culture of Turkey, something which is not necessarily related with Islamism of AKP. So how do you explain that?
It's kind of like, again, one of the questions that we don't have like a particular response in the literature. But it's true, when Erdogan came to, Erdogan's party, the AKP, is coming from the political Islamist tradition in Turkey, which started maybe, to flourish in the 1970s and mostly, after the 1980s. But, it's also important to underline maybe that the party itself didn't really use this term, political Islamist. They were referring to themselves or more like conservative Democrats or, with different adjectives, like as in the case of, for example, Ennahda in Tunisia, right? So one, one explanation in this regard, which I also find more convincing, is coming from Şebnem Gümüşçü, who is like working on political party structures. And she's suggesting that the turn in this, more democratic to authoritarian policies within AKP can be explained by looking at the structure of the party, right? So like we have to analyze the different rivalries within party structures, and we can explain this shift by who in the political party captured the power and was able to, eliminate more, let's say, the quote-unquote moderators. But it's true, as you said, for a very long time, AKP and Turkey, actually, in this regard, was presented as the role model for the rest of the, let's say, MENA region, because they were able to combine more Islamist, background with a move towards, democratization. And in this regard, it's quite important to look at the kind of like the dynamics between different region, different countries and their political Islamist movements and their interaction with each other. For example, we know that, Turkey sided strongly with the Muslim Brotherhood, after the Arab uprisings. We are seeing that, Ennahda closely, in Tunisia, closely followed the AKP's model. So it's kind of important to look at the structures as well. But of course, I cannot say that, Jane White is wrong in this. It's true, Turkey has unfortunately never been a fully, democratic country. It always had this, polarization, as I explained before. So some can trace this back to, the foundation of the republic itself. So it all depends on, what kind of an approach you are adopting. I would also add, the Islamist tradition that Erdogan and his party are coming from are also important, because we are seeing that they are carrying out this neo-Ottomanist, foreign policy, where they are claiming to be like the de facto leader of the Muslim world. And this is why they are trying to strengthen their, relationships with the region. But also we are seeing a more, important role played by the Diyanet, you know, like the presidency of religious affairs in recent years. And the head of Diyanet is, you know, like, for example, attending some of the cultural meetings, for example, the opening of the new, you know, like Türk Evi, which is like the diplomatic and cultural hub of Turkey in the US. Mm. So, you know, like they are bringing Islam to more, you know, like non-religious aspects of social and political life too. So in this regard, it can be suggested also that their ideology is also playing a hand. And it's difficult, I would say, to exclude one of these explanations.
Sure.
Maybe, you know, like all of them contributed to the fact.
Yeah. So, I mean, in this sense, Shadi Hamid, who has come up with a new book, The Challenge of Democracy, mm-hmm. he is of strong idea that Islamism should not be blamed for any kind of de-democratization which happens, because de-democratization, in terms of ideology, it comes from different other backgrounds. But let me ask you the last question, and that comes from your last remark about how party structures may also lead to this. And in case of Turkey, some may argue that the cleavage somehow intensified between Erdogan, who is, I mean, kind of much more radical, but on the other hand, the president which came in 2013, Abdullah Gül, and he somehow tried to take a different stance, which was not so radical, so conservative as compared to Erdogan. Do you agree with that kind of? Was it this shift which Erdogan finally sidelined Abdullah Gülen?
Yeah, I think, you know, like based on, as I said, the literature and the works of, you know, like several of our colleagues, I would say this was one of the like main rivalries within the party. It is suggested that, you know, like Abdullah Gül had a more moderate stance. And this is why, you know, like eventually he and his, like, let's say, followers were sidelined from the party. And, you know, like there have been, you know, like several, let's say, attempts from the opposition to actually like nominate Abdullah Gül as more like a moderate figure who can, you know, like bring together the moderate Islamists as well as, you know, like maybe some of the opposition. And also, you know, like today we see that Ahmet Davutoğlu, who was also part of, you know, like Erdogan's AKP, that's coming from, you know, like a political Islam background, and also, you know, like figures like Abdülhatif Şener, they're also part of the main opposition now. So yes, in that regard, it can be suggested that the shift in, you know, like shift towards more authoritarian politics was a result of this sidelining of the moderate Islamists within the party.
Well, on that note, I think we come to end of this, but truly grateful for your time and this insightful perspective that you provided us on Turkey's de-democratization and democratic backsliding.
Thank you, Omar. It was my pleasure.